This is the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. I'm Ann Clark, a member of the Commonwealth Club and chair of the Environment and Natural Resources member-led forum. Our program tonight is The El Niño Effect, the April update, California water, snowpack, and drought, with Michael Carlin, Deputy General Manager, San Francisco Public Utility Commission, Patrick Koppel, Executive Director, Tuolumne River Trust, and Peter Dreckmeyer, Policy Director of the Tuolumne River Trust. What we'll discuss tonight is where we are now at the end of April and the most recent information about what the year ahead might hold. So, Michael, will you begin with us?
No, I think Peter's
going to begin. I'm sorry. Peter Dreckmeyer from the Tuolumne River Trust.
Thank you so much, Ann, and good to see everyone here. So I'm going to start with just a little tour of the Tuolumne and talk about some of the issues that our organization works on. The Tuolumne is the river that provides water for more than 2.5 million people in the Bay Area. San Francisco County, most of San Mateo County, northern Santa Clara County, and southern Alameda County. So it really is a resource that we all appreciate and depend on. This is a map of the Tuolumne. It starts in Yosemite National Park, drains the northern half. The southern half is drained by the Merced River, which carves out the Yosemite Valley. But the Tuolumne is in the north. The Hetch Hetchy Reservoir, where we store our water, is in Yosemite. A lot of times when I ask people if they know where their water comes from, they'll say Hetch Hetchy. And that's true, but it's kind of like saying our food comes from Safeway. Really, our water comes from the Tuolumne River. It's stored in Hetch Hetchy. And then it flows out of Yosemite. You can see another large reservoir, Don Pedro. That's primarily for irrigation of agricultural lands in the Central Valley, about 200,000 acres. And then it flows down through the city of Modesto, connects with the San Joaquin River, flows north into the Delta and Bay, and some of it even makes it out through the Golden Gate into the Pacific Ocean. So that's the natural journey of the Tuolumne. This is the Mount Lyell Glacier. It's the headwaters of the Tuolumne, the very beginning. And it doesn't contribute a lot of water, but it does make sure that the Lyell Fork of the upper Tuolumne has water year-round throughout the summer. Most of the precipitation comes down as snow, and the snowpack stores that water into the summer, releasing it slowly. And as the snowpack melts, it forms all sorts of streams that start coming together and become the Tuolumne River. And here is the Tuolumne River in Tuolumne Meadows, which is one place where people get to see it quite often. And then it flows down to the Grand Canyon of the Tuolumne, wonderful backpacking country. And what you see a lot of in this photo is granite, which Yosemite is famous for. It doesn't erode. It's very hard. It erodes very slowly. So you have these wonderful vistas. You have waterfalls. And there's not a lot of sediment in the water. So our water is some of the best drinking water in the world. It doesn't have to be filtered. It gets treated with chloramine when it gets to the Bay Area. But it's an incredible water supply. And so good that when Willie Brown was mayor, he toyed with the idea of bottling Hetch Hetchy water, making a little extra income for the city of San Francisco. This is the Hetch Hetchy Reservoir. And the dam there that creates the Hetch Hetchy Reservoir is named O'Shaughnessy Dam. And that is named after Michael O'Shaughnessy, who around the last turn of the century was an engineer with the city of San Francisco and was tasked with coming up with a reliable water supply to provide for San Francisco and surrounding communities as the population grew, especially after the gold rush. And they identified the Hetch Hetchy Valley is a good place to store water. It's a nice, big, open valley that narrows down at the bottom. So with a relatively small dam, you could create a very good reservoir here. You can see the Tuolumne flowing down the middle in this historic photo. You can also notice a couple of waterfalls over there on the left. But there was opposition. John Muir and the Sierra Club were very opposed to building a dam in a national park and convinced Congress to say no. But as we know, in 1906, there was the great earthquake and fire, and San Francisco went back to Congress and said, we really need a reliable water supply to make sure this doesn't happen again. And in 1913, Congress passed the Raker Act, which allowed San Francisco to build the O'Shaughnessy Dam, creating the Hetch Hetchy Reservoir, and you can see the waterfalls there. And that is the primary source of water for 2.6 million people in the Bay Area. It also generates hydroelectricity on its way here, so there are many uses of Tuolumne River water. We also share the river with many other species. These are rainbow trout, just downstream of O'Shaughnessy Dam. And rainbow trout are a really fascinating species. They're always born in freshwater. They start off as eggs, and they can live their whole life there and reproduce. But if they have a chance to get to the ocean, they'll make a long journey, sometimes hundreds of miles, and they'll change from a freshwater fish into a saltwater fish called a steelhead. And they can get very big in the ocean because there's a lot of food there. And when it's time to spawn, they have to come back to freshwater. And they try to come back to the same river or stream where they were born to lay their eggs. And we don't have any steelhead in the section immediately below O'Shaughnessy Dam because of the other big dam downstream, which is Don Pedro. But we still do have rainbow trout, which are a great source of food for river otters, one of my favorite species. Bald eagles, which we have in the Tuolumne watershed. This one's about to catch a fish. Black bears, and many other species. Tuolumne is also home to Homo sapiens. Here are some who are rafting the world-class Tuolumne River. There's an 18-mile stretch, class 4, beautiful canyon, a great way to escape the hustle and bustle of the urban environment. And something I love about it is we usually do two-day trips, so we camp out, and we get a chance to explore the side canyons. There's great swimming. Some people like to go fly fishing, wonderful wildlife. Just a wonderful getaway and not too far from home. And so for all these reasons, the upper Tuolumne River, the upper 83 miles, was designated a wild and scenic river in 1984. And that was the first campaign that Tuolumne River Trust was involved with. So that was our very beginning. You can kind of see the watershed here. There's the Don Pedro Reservoir. So everything upstream, except for the Hetch Hetchy Reservoir, is wild and scenic. But downstream is a special area, too. 2 miles downstream of Don Pedro, which is this dam here, which is 600 feet tall, is the LaGrange Dam, which was built in 1893. And this actually takes water that's stored at Don Pedro and directs it through canals for irrigation in the Central Valley, the Turlock Irrigation District and Modesto Irrigation District. And again, it's 200,000 acres that's irrigated with this water. This is also the terminus of another wonderful aquatic species, which is Chinook salmon. And these are like steelhead in that they're born in freshwater, but they have to go to the ocean to mature and come back and spawn. So we only have salmon downstream of LaGrange and Don Pedro dams. These are also called king salmon because, as you might guess, they are the largest salmon. And they don't normally get this big. This one weighed 108 pounds. Normally they get to be 30 or 40 pounds. But they're really a fascinating species. They're born in freshwater. They migrate out to the ocean in the spring, will live there for a few years, and when it's time to spawn, they will stop eating, and they'll come back to their natal stream if it's available. The female will lay about 5,000 eggs. The male will fertilize them, and then they die. And they provide a great source of food for the food web. They bring all sorts of nutrients from the ocean into upland habitats. And they are a keystone species because there are more than 100 species that depend on salmon, from the time they're eggs to juveniles to adults. And, of course, human beings are one of those species, especially some of the early Californians who depended on salmon for many, many centuries before the modern times. So the challenge is that we have this wonderful water supply in a state that is semi-arid, and we actually divert directly about 60% of the river's flow. And just like at the state level, where about 80% of the developed water, the water we use, goes to agriculture, that's the case with the Tuolumne. About 80% of the diverted water is used for agriculture and about 20% for urban areas.
in the Bay Area. And a lot of the rest of the water is recharging groundwater. Some of it evaporates. So on average, only about 20% of the Tuolumne's natural flow reaches the San Joaquin River and onto the Bay Delta. So this is a slide showing the hydrograph, the flow of water from 1994. And some of you might remember our last extended drought, 1987 to 92, where the reservoirs were very depleted. So we did have a good water year in 94, but a lot of that was captured to replenish those reservoirs. So the bluish gray is what would be seen in the river if there were no dams or diversions. That would be the natural flow. And the green down at the bottom is what the fish actually saw. So it was almost like they were in another year of drought because so much was being captured for human use. And low river flows have had an impact. Before there were any dams on the Tuolumne, there were an estimated 130,000 salmon spawning in an average year. Last year, we were down to 434. So it's just a fraction of the historic numbers. Back around 2000, there was a look at the potential for earthquakes and damaged infrastructure in the Bay Area, and the USGS estimated a 63% chance that there would be a large earthquake that could impact the Hetch Hetchy line. As you see, the red line coming in crosses several major earthquake faults. So at that point, the SFPUC embarked on what's called the Water System Improvement Program, which we're paying for now, and it's a great insurance policy. And there's over 80 capital improvement projects to make sure that the system that brings us our water can withstand a major earthquake. This is the tunnel that brings water into the Bay Area, New Irvington Tunnel. You can see people working in there. It's quite a large tunnel. A big project is the Calaveras Dam on the border between Santa Clara and Alameda counties, and that's been a really big project. At the time, they also looked at population growth, and population growth drives a lot of our resource consumption, and some, including myself, would say it's really at the heart of most environmental challenges we face. And so, thinking ahead, there was a proposal in the plan to divert an additional up to 25 million gallons of water per day to meet future demand projections. We were very concerned about that. The Tuolumne is already struggling, and that would be enough water to fill 1,000 swimming pools every day. So we commissioned a report, and we found that the demand projections were probably inflated, and the potential for conservation was underestimated. So we did a lot of media work around this, got some articles and news segments, turned out a lot of people to the public hearings, and the San Francisco PUC did a great thing and came to us and said, hey, maybe we can reach a compromise here. And it took a number of negotiating sessions, but we did agree to not oppose the project. We supported the seismic upgrades, and they agreed to cap water sales at current levels until 2018. And it was really amazing. It's pretty rare for a project this size to go unchallenged. So we were all in the same boat at this point, and we started working together to promote water conservation. I tell people the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission is the leader nationally on conservation and water reuse and other progressive ways of dealing with our watersheds, protecting the environment. So we're really fortunate in this area. One low-hanging fruit is landscape irrigation. You can have wonderful landscapes like this with native plants that are drought-tolerant that have evolved in this climate without using a lot of water. We're seeing a lot of recycled water used, and San Francisco has a couple of projects in the works right now. This is a project down in San Jose. It's the Silicon Valley Advanced Water Purification Center, which is creating 8 million gallons of water per day of essentially drinking water quality water. There are still some obstacles to that, regulations, the yuck factor from people, but when you think about it, all of our water is recycled. It's whether nature does it or we do it ourselves. And eventually, this water is probably going to go into the drinking water system when the regulations are okay with that and when people are comfortable with it. So we've been very, very successful. Even before the drought kicked in, we were down to 15 to 20% below the cap from 2008. The cap was 265 million gallons of water per day. We were averaging about 225 million gallons per day. So working together, very, very successful. And you can see that historically we used quite a bit of water in the red. Our goal for last year under the governor's mandate to reduce water use on average by 25% is the black dotted line, and blue is what we accomplished, which was really amazing. Thank you, Michael, for your late leadership on that. Last year, we used about 185 million gallons per day. So we were way below the 265 cap that was established in 2008. And you can see we actually, I believe, used even less water than 1977 last year. And Michael confirms that. And that includes the growing population. There's a lot more people in the service area than in 77. So pretty phenomenal what we accomplished. BOSCA, which is the Bay Area Water Supply and Conservation Agency, that oversees or represents all of the wholesale customers outside of San Francisco. They've reworked their demand projections for 2040, and they're down 20%, so it looks like they're going to be whole unless there's a long-term drought. So that's really good news, especially considering that climate change is really something that's going to challenge us in the coming years. We don't know exactly what's going to happen, but a study did suggest we could have up to 30% less water available by 2100 in the Tuolumne watershed. That's more of an extreme in the study, but things are changing every day. And here's the Mount Lyell Glacier where we started. You can see on the left September 2009 and then September 2014. It's actually no longer a glacier technically, because a glacier has to have enough mass to be moving downhill. And the geologists at Yosemite National Park believes it probably will be gone in the next 5 to 10 years. So if you want to visit the Mount Lyell Glacier, do it soon. And just a reminder that we depend fully on the environment. It is our natural resource base. We have a responsibility to protect it for ourselves and for future generations and other species. And the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission has a great environmental stewardship policy, a watershed environmental improvement program, and many other programs. So we should be very proud in San Francisco and the Bay Area for the great leadership from people like Michael Carlin, who will be coming up next.
Thank you, Peter. I'm not going to pay you this week. You're no longer on staff. One of the things I like to say is, with Patrick and Peter, we really do work together collaboratively, and that's really important when you're in a situation like we are, whether it's the drought, whether it's an environmental issue with the Chinook salmon, whether it's a relicensing of a hydroelectric plant. All of those things are things that we deal with every day. And on top of that, we deal with disasters, we meet our customers' needs, and we try to do that in an environmentally sustainable manner. He covered this quite a bit in his presentation, but just to remind you, we're just a department in the City, County, and San Francisco. We actually serve water to 2.6 million people in the Bay Area. So we have 26 wholesale customers. Most of them are cities or municipalities. We have two private entities. One's California Water Service Company, which is an investor-owned utility. The other one is Stanford. So for those of you who work at Stanford. And just to let you know that Hetch Hetchy Water and Power, which is the unit that we're talking about that was affected by the Rim Fire, provides about 85% of our water supply. So we have watersheds in the Bay Area in San Mateo County and Alameda County. You might have seen them along 280 Crystal Springs Reservoir, or if you're over in Alameda County, Calaveras Dam. And those do supply about 15% of our water supply. The water is not filtered, but it's rather treated, so it's safe. We do disinfect it. We use ultraviolet light and chlorinate the water as well. And all our power facilities that we talk about, our bigger power facilities, are up in the Sierras, our hydroelectric plants. And one of the things that Peter showed was that great rafting on the river. And that great rafting happens in the summer because we modulate the flow coming out of our hydroelectric plants to create that summertime rafting that does take place. Otherwise, in the normal hydrograph, there would be no rafting. So it's something that we do. We work with the rafting community, and it does cost us some dollars, but it's okay. So what we're really trying to focus on is where was the rim fire? And where was the rim fire? It was up in the Sierras. We have three reservoirs up there, actually five. Hetch Hetchy is the largest one we always talk about. Lake Eleanor is actually in Yosemite National Park as well. We don't talk about that as much. That was actually the first reservoir that was built and completed in 1918 for power production to build the O'Shaughnessy Dam. And then we have Lake Lloyd, which was completed in 1960. And that's another facility that we get power production out of. But all these reservoirs could eventually be water supply for the city. You can see that we have powerhouses coming out of Cherry, which is at Home Powerhouse. And we have a powerhouse coming out of O'Shaughnessy Dam. It goes into a tunnel. So the water's not coming out of the river. It goes into a tunnel, and it goes down to the powerhouse at early intake, and it's called Kirkwood Powerhouse. The water travels, you know, down to Moccasin, where we have another powerhouse. There's two balancing reservoirs, Priest and Moccasin Reservoir. Then it goes into a tunnel, and it never sees the light of day again until you drink it. It comes down, and unless we put it in one of our local reservoirs, it's 165 miles away. We can get that water to San Francisco by gravity. There's not a pump on that system. So when you think about it, it's a pretty amazing system where the water starts at 4,000 feet and ends up at 220 feet in a reservoir in San Francisco. So this is just a map of what we're talking about on the rim fire. And I've got some other presentations, but I want to just give you the scope of how big was this area that the fire encompassed. And it really started actually in a place where way down, if I can point this out on the map, actually way down in this area here. So you can see the fire actually started that, and then it blew east, and it blew north, and it blew south, but it didn't blow west. And that's what had us really concerned because the fire was very, very rapid. Started on August 17th. The event was being managed by the U.S. Forest Service, approximately 40 acres, not bad. You know, we see a lot of lightning strikes. We see get a lot of calls about fires. It's not like, you know, we get worried. We respond. We have emergency response teams. At the end of the day, it was 442 acres. Still, you know, I got the call. We're not worried. Crews are on it. Forest Service is fighting it. Not a big deal. Next day, it doubles. And then the wind started picking up. You know, a couple days later, it's up to 9,000 acres. And this is our incident command center in Moccasin, so our folks are now on it. You know, they're liaisoning with the U.S. Forest Service. We're figuring out what we have to do because at this point, the Forest Service is telling us we have to shut down our power plants and our energy lines. And these are our transmission lines because what happens with transmission lines, these are high-voltage transmission lines, they can ignite a fire if there's smoke in the area. And the firefighters don't want to go fight a fire underneath live wires, as you can imagine. This is not the voltage in your house. This is the voltage that kills you. You know, so these are 230 kV lines, and you can see helicopters are dropping water right near our lines. August 21st, it's up to 16,000 acres. A couple days later, it's up to 54,000 acres. A couple days later, it's up to 134,000 acres. This is how fast this fire started moving. And this is what had us really, really scared. Now, you have to remember, we're still delivering water out of Hetch Hetchy this whole time. We kind of put it on autopilot. We were monitoring our remote equipment. Our crews were able to go in and change the batteries out on our monitoring devices. So we're kind of still thinking, okay, maybe they'll get this thing out. But the fire continued to burn. And, you know, this is the amazing thing. I love this cartoon from the Chronicle. Is people had no concept, as Peter mentioned, like, where does your water come from? It comes from someplace else. It can't be affected. Yet, you know, here we are sitting in the Bay Area, and we're getting really nervous that this fire is going to go on for a long time. And the ash that would fall on Hetch Hetchy Reservoir would make the water quality such that we couldn't use that water. We couldn't deliver that water. But by September 12th, we deactivated our emergency command center, but we had 257,000 acres were burnt. one of the largest wildfires in Sierra history. And you can see the devastation. I mean, this was a treed, wooded area at one point in time. This was our powerhouse, and you get a sense of, you know, how close. This fire burned right through all our facilities. This is how fire, you know, it's really amazing. It burned through our facilities. We didn't get any damage. Then the fire, the wind changed, and it burned back through our facilities, and we lost the roof to this powerhouse. It fell in on, these are two large hydroelectric units. These are enough hydroelectricity to make 160 megawatts, which is pretty much, you can, powers like San Francisco Airport, powers all the police stations, powers all the schools in the San Francisco, and these are shut down, and these were damaged. We also lost our distribution lines, and these are not the high-voltage lines. We didn't get any damage to the high-voltage lines, but the distribution lines provide electricity to our facilities to allow our people to work. And they also power all our monitoring equipment, all our computers, and everything else. This is the low-voltage stuff that you see out in the streets of San Francisco or in your communities, and we lost all of that. This is the burned area emergency response teams. These are the folks that go in after the fire to assess how much damage has been done and to assess the ecological values that have been damaged, to come up with like plans of what should be done for restoration. And we were part of these teams. We worked closely with the U.S. Forest Service and others. And I think it was important for us to be there because we really wanted to understand what values were actually lost. Not just talking about, you know, the simple values, but we were also talking about the ecological values, but, you know, the roadways, slope stabilization, and everything else. And that was one of the big things is, you know, we still are facing it right now. We get rock slides. You know, you think about it, the fire was so intense and so hot, it heated up all the rocks along the roadways and heated up the rocks in many places. And when you get that freezing and thawing effect, this past winter, you know, we get a call like, you know, we have rocks on the road. Okay. What are we going to do? No, you don't understand. We have big rocks on the road. Okay. Call somebody, get a contractor in and blow it up and you push it off the road. That's the kind of rock slides we were starting to experience. But this is what, you know, is happening now. We were kind of blessed. If you look at this chart and I look at the black line, that's the median year. So that means that basically that's where you kind of want to be to have the system run really well. And this is precipitation at Hetch Hetchy in the water in different water years. This green line is 2015. So it was terrible that we were in a drought, but it was good that we were in a drought because we were able to go in and fix a lot of things and prepare for the inevitable, you know, big winter that we would be facing. If we were facing a 1983 winter, which was the biggest on record so far, we would have massive runoff on our property, and actually not our property, the Yosemite National Park and the forest, Stanislaus National Forest, that we would have to contend with a lot more erosion, a lot more washouts, a lot more just catastrophic failure. But we were able in this year to go in and actually do a lot of that work in advance. The red line is where we are today. So you can see we are above the median. We're doing better than we, you know, expected. In fact, when you look at our system today, we are going to fill Hetch Hetchy this year. In fact, if you have time, I would advise you in the next 3 to 4 weeks to go to Yosemite National Park or go up to Hetch Hetchy because the waterfalls will be spectacular. And then after that, good luck. but it was a very good year for us, but it also brought, like I said, rock slides and other things that actually we have to deal with. One of them is just erosion. And we put in a lot of different culverts. The Forest Service put in culverts. There's a lot of new roadways that are paved up there when you go up there these days. And you'll see that there's larger structures underneath some of these roadways just to convey, because they know that the water won't be retained, won't infiltrate into a lot of these areas. It's just going to run off. And so you have to convey that water someplace. We also rebuilt a lot of roads, put in a lot of new guardrails, but one of the things that you should take into account in this photograph, look at all the trees. They're all burnt. I mean, this was to be a very pretty sort of drive. You know, you're driving down, you have the trees on both sides, and now you have these stretches of like burnt out areas or no trees at all. And this kind of gives you where, you know, our distribution lines have gone back in. But there used to be trees here. And so they were kind of hidden. Now you can actually see all our facilities from the roads. Before, you'd never be able to see them. They were kind of hidden. And now it's like, hey, I know what that is. And people go, why is that pipe hanging on the side of that mountain? And it's just a really, really sad thing. This is actually on Cherry Creek. This is a diversion structure that we rebuilt. We have the ability to drop water out of Cherry Creek. We divert it here. We put it into a tunnel called Cherry Aqueduct, take it down to early intake, and then we can put it into our system if we want to for drinking water purposes. This was totally destroyed. I mean, you can see it's a wooden structure. It didn't look like this. This is actually better looking than the other one. But it was totally destroyed, and we actually rebuilt it and have reoperated it to make sure that we have the ability to bring in water and emergency purposes from Cherry Creek. Here's Huckleberry Lake. Doesn't look that bad this year. I mean, this is in high country. This is actually Frank Gerke, who's the chief snow surveyor for the Department of Water Resources. He loves going up to our property because we put him up. And, you know, it was a very good year for us. In fact, it was snowing earlier today in the high country. So we had a very good year. We're very fortunate. And, you know, what we see now is basically a comeback of some of the native vegetation, but the trees are going to take some while to come back. So thank you.
This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is the El Nino Effect, the April Update, California Water, Snowpack, and Drought, with Michael Carlin, who you just heard from, who's Deputy General Manager, San Francisco Public Utility Commission. And you also heard from earlier Peter Dreckmeyer, Policy Director, Tuolumne River Trust. Now it's my pleasure to introduce you to Patrick Koppel, who is the Executive Director of the Tuolumne River Trust. Patrick?
Thanks a lot, Ann. So I think this is perfect. Michael set me up here with a review of the Rim Fire and what's been going on. I'm going to start off just a couple of slides here talking about what the Tuolumne Trust has been doing with the Rim Fire, but then delve in a little bit more into broader forest health issues. So let's get going here. I live up in Sonora, up in the foothills of Tuolumne County, and I have been part of a collaborative effort over the past few years called the Yosemite Stanislaus Solutions. And we call it YSS. YSS was formed basically back maybe around 2010 or so to put together a plan to address forest health issues so that we could actually avoid a rim fire type event from happening. Unfortunately, plans take a while to put together and didn't come together in time, and the rim fire erupted. But briefly, the trust put together a pretty amazing program this past year involving volunteers in the restoration and recovery effort of the Rim Fire. And we brought in over 1,300 volunteers who contributed almost 18,000 volunteer hours and planted 60,000 trees, restored miles of trails, and pulled noxious weed from 40 acres of meadows and other areas, fenced off sensitive plant areas, and did a pretty incredible job of helping the forest. And Seth Connolly, who led that effort, just did a phenomenal job, brought in people really from all across North America. We had people coming from northern Alberta, from Boston, and of course, Modesto, San Francisco, and other places. So it's pretty neat. So as we heard before, Rim Fire burned 257,000 acres. It's the largest recorded fire in the Sierra Nevada. The red outline here is the Rim Fire footprint, and this is the Tuolumne watershed. So it had a really big impact. It burned about 20% of the entire watershed. And just as a footnote, in case you're not familiar with the concept of watershed, that's basically any rain or snow that falls on this patch of land here is going to drain into the Tuolumne River. And so things that happen upstream affect what happens downstream and vice versa. So it's important that we think about what's happening in our watershed. We heard about all the water supply that we get from the Tuolumne River. We also get irrigation water, power generation, and home to quite a diverse array of fish and wildlife, California spotted owls, great gray owls, willow flycatchers, and the list goes on and on. And, of course, it's a favorite recreational resource for people from really from around the world. It's a world-class whitewater destination. Many Bay Area family camps and sleepaway camps that are housed up in the Tuolumne watershed. Just to give you an idea of what the river looks like before and after the rim fire, Peter gave me these slides here today. Here's a shot before the fire, and after you can see the sedimentation that's really flowing into the river there. There's, again, before, nice blue and white water, and brown afterwards. So when the fire was burning back in 2013, my son and daughter, my son was about 4 years old, my daughter was maybe 2.5, and just the other day my son said to my daughter, Phoebe, do you remember the rim fire? You know, for my son, it was kind of this event. My daughter, not quite so sharp in her memory. And unfortunately, that's probably the case for all of us, that it's kind of becoming more fuzzy because, you know, this is a, one event, but it's really just one symptom of a bigger issue that the forests are facing up in the Sierra. So I want to talk a little bit about some of the pressures that the forests are facing and some of the things that have been building up for decades, really, that are affecting forest health. Starting with fire exclusion. So here we have a historic photo from the 30s. The Forest Service back in the 30s instituted what they call the 10 a.m. policy. And the idea behind the 10 a.m. policy was to put out a fire by 10 a.m. the next day, the day after that fire was first identified and first noticed. And this 10 a.m. policy was the policy of the Forest Service through the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, into the 70s when some of the foresters started to think and say, hey, you know what? This might not be the best policy that we should be implementing. Western forests have really evolved over millennia to need forests, need fire. And fire comes through periodically and burns away the extra growth, burns away the underbrush, and it's kind of the housekeeper of the forest. And in the Sierra Nevada, fires burn through roughly every 5 to 10 years. Reduces the competition amongst for the biggest and oldest trees, removing the smaller, younger trees. So we're left with the healthiest, strongest trees that can withstand fire, but they can also they're resilient through drought periods. And so after decades of fire exclusion, we've built up many more and more smaller trees, and they've become more and more dense throughout the forest. Another pressure that the forests have seen and that's built up over the years is, of course, logging, but specifically logging of the largest trees. The big old trees are the ones that can, as I mentioned, can withstand fires that come through. The smaller fires that burn through every 5 to 10 years that aren't as hot and they're not as severe. Not the rim fire type fires, but the smaller, more periodic fires. And of course, these were the trees that provided the biggest source of revenue. And it's no mystery that loggers would want to select for those trees. Here you see in the top photo what you'd call a one log load, and you never see a tree or a truckload coming out of the forest like that anymore, because those trees just don't exist. And even, you know, a three log load is very, very rare to see anymore these days. So what do you see as a result of both the fire exclusion and the selection of the largest trees? Back in the 20s, you would see areas that are much more lightly packed with trees, whereas nowadays you've got a pretty densely packed forest. You also saw much bigger trees back then and many, many more small trees these days. There's a forest area called the Stanislaus Tuolumne Experimental Forest up near Pinecrest. It's along the North Fork of the Tuolumne. And back in the 30s, the Forest Service did this pretty amazing thing where they went through and they mapped every single tree in that patch of land. And recently, they've gone back and remapped it. And the growth rate has just been phenomenal, because in the intervening period, there haven't been these fires coming through. And it's much, much more densely packed with trees and much more, many more smaller trees. So they've done many surveys like this, both in the Tuolumne watershed and in other areas of the Sierra Nevada. And one study found that back in 1911, they had as few as 19 trees per acre. And now, in a more recent survey, they had 225 trees per acre. Just incredible, the difference there. You find this kind of density change is pretty common now, where tree densities are that were one time maybe 20 to 100 trees per acre are now 2 to 400 trees per acre. It's a real situation where the forest has grown up and there's a lot of fuel there that can start burning again. So what does this look like? The light's a little bit bad, but here's a photo from 1914. You can see there's a few big trees with a lot of space between them, kind of a more open canopy. There might be patches of more dense trees back in the background. And now you've got just a thicket of lots of small trees, kind of a continuous canopy, and a fire can really get in the canopy and just race through there with no problem. Okay, so we've got fire exclusion. We've got selective logging of the biggest trees. Now we've got climate change, which Peter mentioned. Here's the Lyell Glacier. The San Francisco Chronicle did a story of this last year, and this photo series appeared there. Here's the Lyell Glacier in 1883. Here it is, 2015. It's sinking. It's shrinking fast. So as Peter said, go visit it now. It might be gone within the next 5 to 10 years. So we don't know exactly what the effects of climate change are on our forests, but undoubtedly there will be effects. And there's a lot of questions. How do we manage our forests with climate change putting this new pressure on them? Will we still have the mixed conifer forests of the Sierra? Or will the forest convert to oak woodlands and chaparral? A whole host of questions that we need to kind of face. We have, of course, over the past 4 years, drought has been a big impact. El Nino didn't deliver quite the punch that some of the prognosticators were saying back in the fall. We did see some relief this year. I checked the Department of Water Resources website yesterday. We're at about 105% of average precipitation to date for the year, but our snowpack is actually only 67% of average. It's been a fairly warm winter, and so instead of getting snowfall, we've been getting rainfall, and what snow we did get has been melting. But it is better. Here's last year. This is this year. Quite a bit better snowpack. If the light was better, you'd also see there's a lot more green in this photo, much more brown. The U.S. Drought Monitor has determined that our drought condition improved from the very worst level, termed an exceptional drought, to one step better, where we're now just extreme, merely extreme. And so it's a bit of an improvement, and we're glad for that. So where has this all of, you know, these different factors led? Of course, it's led to bigger and more severe forest fires. There are hundreds of thousands of acres that burned in the Rim Fire, but last year we had the Rough Fire down near Sequoia Kings Canyon, which burned 115,000 acres. The year before that, the King Fire, which burned 97,000 acres. These are the largest fires in the history of the Sierra, and they've just been in the past few years. Basically, the trend line of total acres burned in the Sierra Nevada is not good. It's going up, and so that's something that we're concerned about. And now, unfolding over the past 2 years is the beetle kill, drought and beetle kill of our trees. We've got a really incredible tree mortality that's occurring. The latest estimate that I've seen is 29 million trees are dead, and that number is growing. If you drive up anywhere from basically Tuolumne County, Yosemite, and south, you'll see vast tracts of brown trees. And it's very disturbing to see. And this really just occurred over the past couple of years. But it's, again, it's been something that's building over decades. The beetles are always there. And it's these conditions that come together and that really enable the beetles to attack the trees. They, what they do is they bore through the bark. And if the tree has plenty of water, they produce enough sap to push the beetles back out, but when it's a drought condition, they don't have that defense. So perversely, these millions of dead trees create more fuel for additional fires, and unless we see some dramatic measures taken to remove some of the trees, I'd expect that we'd see more and more severe and large fires consuming hundreds of thousands of acres. And this all plays into climate change. We've always thought of forests as a carbon sink, that trees grow, they photosynthesize, they convert carbon dioxide from the atmosphere into organic carbon that makes up their cells. And in a healthy forest, that carbon is stored more or less indefinitely if the forest remains healthy. This is a critical assumption that's incorporated into some of our statewide policies. California's AB 32 greenhouse gas reduction targets assumed that our forests are a net sink of carbon. But as the forests become more and more vulnerable to wildfires, they're at risk of becoming a net source of carbon rather than a net sink. Estimates of the Rim Fire peg greenhouse gas emissions of, at over 11 million metric tons, which is equivalent to the annual emissions of 2.3 million cars. And it basically has eclipsed the greenhouse gas emission target reduction targets for the state for the year of 2013. Perhaps more relevant is that the Rim Fire greenhouse gas emissions replaced almost 3 years of AB 32 program reductions achieved from all other sectors. The Rim Fire emitted five times more greenhouse gas from the much more publicized Porter Ranch natural gas leak, which was the largest ever in U.S. history. So this is not just a forest health concern, but it's really a climate concern as well. Our forests are, and watershed is critically important for, of course, for clean water, for clean air, for fish and wildlife. And in my opinion, we've really reached a tipping point, at least in the Sierra Nevada, where we may witness a complete irreversible stand-changing conversion of our forests to something else, and we don't know what it's going to be. So the good news is that we know the problem that we, and we have a good idea of where we need to go with our forests. Forest science has improved in recent decades. Well, of course, there's much more to learn. We know what the tools are. And we really need to restore a real mixed heterogeneous forest, that what I was talking about earlier, where you've got openings, you've got clumps, you've got single trees, you've got an open canopy, something that's real mixed and diverse rather than sort of the solid stand of of lots of small trees and a closed canopy across the landscape. And to get there, it's going to take a combination of both mechanical thinning and prescribed burning. We've got to remove some of those smaller trees. Currently, between mechanical treatments that the Forest Service is applying, prescribed fires that the Forest Service is applying, and wildfires, we're at about a 400,000 acre per year deficit from what you would potentially see in pre-European times. So what are we doing? We at the Tuolumne River Trust and some of our partners in Tuolumne County are promoting an initiative that does just that, some of the things that I've been talking about. We're trying to significantly increase the pace and scale of management activities, but the only way we're going to do that is if we bring more money and resources to the Forest Service, which has been getting more and more squeezed over the decades to do the work. These are very large projects. They take time to put together, to get through the planning process, and to actually implement on the ground. So just to summarize, the forest really lacks resilience for climate change, for drought, for fires due to past logging and fire exclusion, and the resulting high density of small tree species are vulnerable to fire. And so that's the regime that we're trying to deal with and we're trying to address, and I think we have a direction to get there. I did want to just mention briefly a couple of things that the Tuolumne River Trust, a little promotion here. We've got coming up on May 9th, the Tuolumne River Film and Culture Festival down at Menlo Atherton. You'll learn a little bit more about the Tuolumne River and see some of the great art and film that's been put together recently. I'd invite you to come down to that. And we also have the By Land and By River Adventure Series. Come canoe with us, raft, backpack, cycle, fly fish up in Tuolumne Meadows in Yosemite. This is a fundraiser for the Trust, and we'd love to have you join us. There are many dates from spring through summer, and you can check that out at bylandandbyriver.org. And thanks so much.
This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is the El Nino Effect, the April Update, California Water, Snowpack, and Drought, with Michael Carlin, Deputy General Manager, San Francisco Public Utility Commission, Patrick Kopel, who is the Executive Director of the Tuolumne River Trust, and Peter Dreckmeyer, the Executive Director of the Tuolumne River Trust, and Peter Dreckmeyer is the Policy Director of the Tuolumne River Trust. And we're at that time in our program where we have time for a few questions, and I'd like to start that off, and then I'll come and check with people in the audience and ask each of our speakers tonight, and the talks have really been wonderful, and I certainly have learned a lot, so personally I want to thank you. So, Patrick, starting with you, we'll just come down the road. What scares you the most?
Well, I guess what scares me the most is maybe not having the political will to fix a major problem that I think is really we're all faced with here with our forests and the source of our drinking water in the state. The Tuolumne watershed is the source of Bay Area drinking water. But the Sierra Nevada as a whole is a source of so much water for the state. And, they're really in a real state of peril with the condition of the forests. And they need quite a bit of attention that they're not getting. And it, for a lot of the population of the state, it's kind of this far-off, distant thing that they don't see. And so it's just hard to make that connection. And so hopefully we find a way to do that and get people a little bit more aware and bring more resources to bear on the problem.
I'll just touch very briefly. It's resources, it's funding. I've been working with my colleagues in Colorado who have had devastating wildfires as well. In Alaska and Nevada and other places in the western United States, this is an endemic problem. and trying to get more funding for the U.S. Forest Service so they're not borrowing money from other parts of the Forest Service to do prevention and maintenance rather to fight fires, that there is a dedicated fund to fight fires.
There's a saying, I don't know if it's true or not, but if you put a frog in boiling water, it'll hop out. But if you put it in warm water and bring it to a boil, it will boil to death.
Yeah.
And I think that is happening with climate change. There are a lot of people who are working really hard, but there are a lot of climate deniers out there. And there's a whole movement funded by fossil fuel interests to propagate that. So climate change is going to have a huge impact. It's obviously driven largely by overpopulation. In my lifetime, I do have a little bit of gray hair, but I'm still kind of young. The human population has more than doubled on planet Earth in my lifetime. So something that gave me a little hope the other day is I was listening to the traffic report on KQED, and the reporter said, and on such and such highway, there's a lot of traffic congestion, and the cause is, well, overpopulation. So I think as people start talking about it more, maybe we'll respond to that.
I have a question. Very short. What's the source of the words Hetch Hetchy and Tuolumne?
Oh, boy. there's a lot of theories on Hetch Hetchy, whether it's the sound, it's Native Americans, basically the sound of the grass blowing or something of that nature. And Tuolumne, I believe, is an Indian.
Yeah, Tuolumne is a Miwok word. I think it sort of roughly is upright standing,
yeah,
but maybe to do with the cliffs and tall rock faces. I'm not exactly sure, though.
And I'll back them up. That my understanding is Hetch Hetchy is also the name of the grasses that grew
right
in the valley.
That's
and the Miwok depended on them at certain times of year. And Tuolumne might mean rock home or steep cliffs. So it's not quite clear, but that's a really good question.
This is a what-if question, but we had a good year this year with rain. But if the drought comes back in again, we see another 5 or 10 years, what does the city need to be doing, or Tuolumne, as far as the next big projects or more conservation issues to address supplying water to the city and the Bay Area in general?
Sure. So I'd say this, we're not out of the drought. Everybody should keep conserving. Having one good year does not mean that we're done. So we expect people to conserve. We expect people to actually use less water. We are trying to build more alternative water supplies, such as recycled water. We're promoting indirect potable reuse here in San Francisco. In our headquarters building, we actually recycle the water from our toilets. We clean it up and we flush our toilets with it. So it uses 60% less water than a normal large Class A office building. We are going to continue to do that. We are actually building groundwater, putting in wells in the west side of San Francisco. We're also working with our customers in the south, in Daly City, South San Francisco, and San Bruno to put in wells to be a drought supply. So there's lots of things we're doing, but we're not out of the drought. Keep conserving.
I have a question. Wait, did you have
no.
another response? Trying to formulate my question, but I think, now that I live in the Bay Area after having lived up in the Sierra for a while, I'm just thinking about kind of the human relationship to the forest and how we can change our relationship to it. Because it seems like there's a need to be more actively managing the landscape. I'm just wondering kind of if you think we have the tools to really do that. Our prescribed fires and the other kind of prescriptions that the Forest Service are doing, are those enough, or is there something more that we can do, and how do we, kind of get people engaged both scientifically and then on a more personal level? Because it seems like if you don't have a connection to these forests, it does feel very remote, and it gets caught up in politics, and people don't believe in federal land management or whatever it is. So, as a community that cares about the Tuolumne watershed, you know, do you see opportunities for people to kind of get more engaged? And when, what are our kind of leverage points, I guess, for improving management of our watershed at a regional scale?
It is a tricky situation. The forests are sort of remote from a lot of the population, and forests aren't necessarily understood that well. We're learning more all the time. I do think we have the physical tools to do what needs to be done. I think we need to bring in prescribed fire again. We do need to apply mechanical treatments as well. Things have switched a little bit. At one time it was exclude fires and clear cut, but now we've brought some more balance back where we don't want clear cuts, but I think, you know, there, maybe it's gone a little bit too far, and we do need to do some treatments. The Forest Service and our national forests are kind of in this tricky position where they have a mandate to provide wood and fiber products, but they also have a mandate to provide fish and wildlife and water supply benefits. And so finding that balance is not easy. And so, you know, I think, frankly, continuing the conversation and being involved is a big part of that, finding that sweet spot.
Unfortunately, we've come to that point in our program, and we have time for one last question.
Well, thank you. You mentioned about political will. It looks like political will advances by experiencing crisis. Reading quickly the 271 pages of the new Water Resources Development Act that's been formulated by both Republican and Democrat, you can see that it's a reflection of the crisis that we had for the lead situation. It's all reflected to lead. Do you see any movement that can show that we have semi-crisis in the situation of forestry?
It's tough. You know, frankly, I think the state is more aware than maybe the federal government is. And right now we do have a governor that I think is sympathetic to forests and certainly is interested in climate change. And climate change is part of what I think he wants to make as part of his legacy. And so timing matters. There's a window of opportunity right now with our current governor and the state of the forests that, you know, I think there is enough crisis to bring attention to the problem. And there are leaders that are interested, maybe not fully engaged yet, but that window of opportunity could close and we'll get a new governor and the fires will be, maybe if we don't see any in the next few years, they'll be a little bit further behind us and become a little bit more of a memory. So I think, timing matters.
You have just heard from, Patrick Koppel, Executive Director of the Tuolumne River Trust. And now we'll hear on the same question from Michael Carlin, who's Deputy General Manager, San Francisco Public Utilities Commission.
You point out a very good thing, the Water Resources Development Act that just passed the Senate, which hopefully goes to the House and, you know, gets passed at some point in time. It doesn't have the kind of relief we're talking about here, but it has other relief for other areas. As I mentioned earlier, you know, I have a lot of colleagues in Colorado and other western states that have experienced large wildfires, and they're very concerned about that. When you think about the watersheds for the major cities on the West Coast, Seattle, Portland, San Francisco, even LA to a certain extent in Southern California, they all have watersheds that are heavily forested where they get their water supply. And there is a great deal of concern to build up, you know, more support for federal legislation to bridge the gap between the U.S. Forest Service, the National Park Service, the Bureau of Land Management. All the other federal agencies have different policies on how they manage their lands, especially when it comes to these very important resources. And we are trying to bridge that gap and work with others to get there. but it is taking a lot of different people bringing the subject up over and over again. We have the disadvantage where there are not a lot of forest fires on the East Coast. There are a lot of other disasters on the East Coast, and they get attention. But when you think about it, in the Western arid United States, we don't get the attention we need. Yet these forests produce products not only for the United States but for the world. And we're getting there, but it's taking some time. So there are some legislative proposals going forward, and it's just a matter of time before we kind of build up enough support to get them through.
And Peter Dreckmeyer, Policy Director, Tuolumne River Trust.
I agree that humans have evolved to respond more quickly to crises and challenges. And a positive of the drought has been that there's been some great innovation in conservation and efficiency and water reuse. And people are talking about indirect potable reuse, where you take advanced purified recycled water, you percolate it down, filter it into the groundwater, and you use that as a drinking water source. Also, the idea of direct potable reuse, where we can put that right into our water supply. A lot of the regulations haven't caught up with that. And a lot of people in the public are still dealing with the yuck factor, but there's great leadership, and I'm seeing city councils embracing the concept, water districts. So I think out of this drought, we are planning for resiliency, and that gives me some hope.
A big thank you for our excellent program tonight, and I really appreciate all that's been shared with us. Please give a big thank you for their work and all that they do and what they brought us tonight to Michael Carlin, Patrick Koval, and Peter Dreckmeyer. So again, a big thanks to them. This was a lot of work, and they've given at least, I know, all of us in the audience a lot to think about and a lot to consider. And many thanks to our audience here. Thank you very much for joining us tonight, and good questions. And thank you to the audience on our radio and the internet. You can find our programs on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. Click on commonwealthclub.org also for multimedia access to programs, current news feeds, streaming audio, radio schedules, and 230 radio stations on national radio networks. Also find audio and video tapes and free weekly podcasts and archive programs. Look for our upcoming programs for the environmental programs. On Thursday, May 12th, Claire Brown, professor of the Graduate School of Economics, UC Berkeley, will talk about the necessity of creating quality of life for a sustainable global environment. Wednesday, May 25th, Charles Curtin, senior fellow for the Center for Natural Resources, Environmental Policy, University of Montana, will talk about the science of open spaces. He will have a book signing. And our last program for spring 2016 is Monday, June 6th, Adriana Quintero, director and founder, Voices Verdes, and director, partner engagement, Natural Resources Defense Council. We'll talk about environment and climate action, priorities for our Latinos and our Latinos. This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. Thank you for being with us. And for all of us in the audience in San Francisco, go Warriors! This meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.